Hello all, and welcome to this online event held at the International Inequalities Institute entitled Homo Plutia, Top Labor and Capital Incomes in the United States. It is part of the International Inequalities Seminar Series, and it is the first event of summer term. It will last until 1:30 British time. My name is Nora Weidkes, and I will be chairing this event. I'm a sociologist and a researcher at the International Inequalities Institute. And today's speaker is Dr. Jonathan Berman. He's a research fellow at the London Mathematical Laboratory, as well as an associate researcher at the Stone Center on Socioeconomic Inequality at City University of New York, and a fellow of the World Inequality Database. His research lies in the intersection of public and labor economics, with specific interest in the evolution of income and wealth distributions, social mobility, and their interrelationship. Today, he will speak about joint work with Branko Milanović on Homo Plutia in the United States since 1950. A note on the technical side of things, as this is a Zoom meeting, it means we can see all our attendees. If you could keep your cameras on and your microphones muted where possible, this will ensure an interactive and smooth running event. We will have time for questions and answers towards the end of the event. Please use the raise hand function if you wish to ask a question to the panel directly, or if you prefer, you can type your questions into the chat function, stating your name and your affiliation in both cases. Before I hand over to Jonathan, I will mention this week's upcoming event at the International Inequalities Institute. On Thursday, May 6th, we have the public event, Are Regional Inequalities Driving Us Apart? Geographical and Political Polarization in an Age of Populism, chaired by III Associate Professor Neil Lee, taking place at 6:30 p.m. Details for the event can be found in the chat function as well, along with more information on further upcoming events. And staying up to date with the work of the International Inequalities Institute. I'll now hand over to our speaker. Thank you everyone for joining, and please enjoy the event.
Thank you, Nora. Let me share my screen with you. All right, sound clear and slides clear? Great. So I'm very glad to be presenting this joint work with Branko Milanović on Homo Plutia, Top Labor and Capital Incomes in the US since 1950. And let me get straight into it. So this cartoon that many of you probably saw similar things in the past, not necessarily this one. I like this one because it's pretty old, it's from 1894. It shows a typical picture of how American capitalism is thought of. We see a capitalist, in this case, it is George Pullman, he's an entrepreneur and engineer who invented some kind of rail carriage, who's paying low wages to workers and he's taking high rents from them because actually they live in houses that he was building for them. And this is a typical picture in many cases that, in many senses that I'll try to explain in a bit. It shows us that there is a capitalist and there's a worker. These are two different people. The workers are paid wages, which are generally low. And the capitalist is earning rents, which are generally high. So basically this is what we describe as the three important facets of the classical view of American capitalism. First, that there is a dichotomy between rich capitalists and poor workers, and that capitalists and workers are separate groups. They are generally different people. Capitalists' incomes come from owning property, whereas workers earn wages. So basically they work for a living. And also that capitalists are at the top of the income distribution and workers are generally in the middle or at the bottom. So this is, again, the classical view of American capitalism. Capitalists and workers are just different people. Capitalists' incomes come from property, whereas workers' incomes come from work. And capitalists are at the top, workers in the middle and the bottom. However, this dichotomy may no longer be relevant. And Homo Plutia, which is the topic of my talk today, is a situation when people at the top of the income distribution are simultaneously top capitalists and top wage earners. Or in other words, there is an overlap, or a large overlap, say, between people who earn high capital incomes and high labor incomes. Why is this important? So there are many reasons why we believe that starting on Pluto is important, and I'll try to motivate it in a few examples. I'm not going to talk in detail about most of them. So first of all, it's relevant for political economy, for the classical study of how capitalist systems actually behave. So we have classical type of capitalism, we have liberal capitalism, we have all sorts of different capitalistic systems which act differently. And this is kind of a new phenomenon that needs to be understood in this context. Another important aspect is that it has theoretical relevance, simply because many models in economics make this distinction between capitalists and workers. And if models indeed make this assumption, and this assumption is no longer valid, that then maybe these models are no longer valid. Another aspect is the empirical relevance. Some studies assume essentially fixed homopluteia. For example, if we have information on capital income from one source, on labor income from another source, and we want to understand what is the distribution of the total income, we can assume something on homopluteia. And if it is assumed to be fixed, which is perhaps not true, then such an empirical exercise would be wrong or perhaps inaccurate. It has implications for social mobility, which I'll try to discuss more in the end of my talk, and maybe we can leave it to the discussion. Another point, more from a policy point of view, is that it's harder to tax the homoplutic upper class, people who have work, who have incomes both from work and capital income, then, for example, if people at the top were merely rentiers, basically earning their income from without working hard for it, which we know now is the case, that people at the top are working harder and harder over time. And again, these points are not points that I'm going to talk a lot about. What I am going to talk more about is how homopluteia acts to increase interpersonal income inequality and how these things are related. So again, this paper is first, how can we define and measure homopluteia? This will be the first thing I'm going to discuss. Then I'm going to present the main empirical results, which are how homopluteia has evolved in the US since 1950. Then I'm going to talk about what might have driven homopluteia up. So I'm already telling you that basically homopluteia went up over the last 70 years. And then I'm going to discuss how homopluteia is related to interpersonal income inequality. In terms of related literature, there are a few things I'd like to mention. Obviously, this is related to things going back to the 19th century, Marx, Ricardo, and all that, but more recent literature, there are also relevant, of course, many relevant papers on the association of labor and capital incomes in the US and Norway, and about capitalists in the US and the structure and composition of their incomes. This is the Smith and Co-authors paper. Sorry. It's also related in a way that I hope I'll have time to talk about more towards the end of my talk. A lot of the inequality literature in the recent decade or so put a lot of focus on the importance of changing capital shares and how the increase in capital shares contributed to increasing inequality. And what we say in this paper is slightly a change of focus, that maybe this change in capital shares might have been important, but focusing only on this change might miss an important aspect, which is the rise in homopluteia. And the third thread of literature that is related is on weight stretching, basically on increasing labor income inequality since the 1980s or even since the 1970s. So just a brief overview of the results. Our poverty was low after World War II. It has increased by the early 1960s and then decreased slightly by the mid 80s. Since 1985, it has been sharply increasing and it is currently at record levels. A second thing that I'm going to try and show that rising poverty is likely to be driven by increasing labor income inequality, and I'll try to discuss the mechanisms that we are thinking about when we are saying this, we are making this claim. And the last thing I'm going to show is that rising poverty accounts for about 20% of the increase in total income inequality in the US since 1986. All right, so let's start with what is poverty and how it can be defined and measured. First, again, poverty is when people at the top of the income distribution are simultaneously top capitalists and top wage earners. This is the reason we actually use this word homoploutia. Ploutia means richness or wealth in Greek. So homoploutia means that the same people are rich in terms of different dimensions. And in our case, it means that they have both high labor incomes and high capital incomes. It is not the same as high capital labor correlation. It is related. I don't suppose I'll have time to talk about it, but it's something a little bit different, especially because our focus is on the top. And we measure it by something we call the top 10K, top 10L. It's the share of top decile capital income recipients who are also in the top decile of labor income. So mathematically, it's very simple. We can think of the indicator function of being in the top 10% of capital income. Again, the indicator function of being in the top decile of labor income. And we simply count how many people are in both and just multiply by 10 over the number of people in the entire population. It's the same as the probability to be in the top decile of capital income, conditional on being on the top decile of labor income. And this is very simple. And as you can see, we simply, if we had perfect data, we could simply just count people, which indeed is what we do in certain cases. But there's another point here that I want to make, is that in the absence of any correlation, say, between labor income recipients and capital income recipients. So if there was no relationship between who gets which kind of income, we would expect this probability to be 0.1 or 10%. So, okay, this is the baseline kind of measure of top 10K, top 10L, when there is no positive or negative rank correlation between capital income recipients and labor income recipients. And so this is important as being a baseline level for homoploutia. Other measures could have been possible. We could have focused on net wealth groups, for example, the top 1% rather than the top 10%, or asymmetric intersections. We could have focused on the bottom decile of both types of income. And we could have focused also on the entire copula, the entire joint distribution of ranks of labor and capital income. And I'm going to discuss the copula later. I'm just saying that this is not the only measure that is possible in order to describe this phenomenon of homoploutia. So now we move to the data sources that we use. So we use three different data sources, which are different in many aspects. And the reason to use three different data sources is first to cover the longest period possible. Second, to make sure that our findings are robust, hoping that these three data sources will give us more or less the same results. And also to see that the results are not really are not dependent on which kind of unit of observation and which kind of data source, either tax data or household service data, we are using. So the data sources we are using are three. Two of them are household surveys, the LIS, the Luxembourg Income Study, which is based on the CPS data for the US. It's a household survey. We use the US DINA, the Distribution of National Accounts, which is mainly about income tax data. You can see the availability in terms of years. And we also look at the SCF Plus. This is an augmented version of the Survey of Consumer Finance. It's also a household survey. The nice thing about the SCF Plus is that it gives us information about a period which the previous two data sources don't include, which is 1950 to 1962. So all three of them are quite different. I'm not going to go into the differences between them, but it's important because they are in a way independent. They have different units of observations and a slightly different availability in terms of time. What is the methodology we apply? Super simple. In each case, in each year, we detect the top decile labor and capital income thresholds. So we just detect how much you need to earn in each type of income to be included in the top decile. Then we simply count how many people are in the intersection of these deciles and divide by the right number. An important caveat of this methodology, which I don't suppose we can somehow overcome, but I feel the need to stress this caveat, because if we could have we could bypass this, we could have done the same exercise and go even back further in time. It cannot be done without microdata. This is the reason we use surveys and we use the DINA from 1962, and we don't use tabulations that are available from the early 20th century. If anyone has an idea, I'll be glad to know. So these are the main results. You can see the different sources. And basically what this figure shows is just how the top 10K, top 10L evolved from 1950 to 2020 in the different sources. First thing we see is that basically from more or less from 1980 or slightly before that, all the sources move more or less in unison. And we also can see generally an increasing trend. The SCF Plus does give something a bit weird here in 1971, which we don't know how to explain exactly. We know that the sample size in this specific year was extremely low, the lowest in the entire time period. But generally speaking, we see that this increasing trend and again, record levels now, and especially this clear increase between the mid 80s and today. So again, it was low after, homoplasia was low after World War II, and low meaning about 10%, which I told you is our baseline level. It has increased by the early 1960s, slightly decreased until the mid 80s, and since 1985, it has been sharply increasing today in record levels. So the different data sets more or less give the same results, especially since 1980. It's important to note that the homoplutic elite, so the people in this intersection of the top decile of capital income and labor income, is fully contained within the general elite, meaning they are fully contained within the top decile of total income. Okay, it doesn't have to be this way, but it is this way. So it's an important thing to note. Other ways to see this change that we're discussing, in this case, we are only looking at the LIS data. We can look at other aspects. For example, we can look at what is the probability to be a top capitalist who don't work. So here you can see it in the gray dotted line, you can see the top 10K, bottom 10L. So people who are at the top decile of capital income, but in the bottom decile of labor income. So back in the 70s, this was more or less the same level as the top 10K, top 10L, but it almost mirrors the dynamics of the top 10K, top 10L, and it has been decreasing. So we have now less and less top capitalists who don't work. We see much less of we don't see a clear signal, a very clear signal in people who are poor in both terms, or are top wage earners who are bottom capital income earners. And a third way to look at this result is to look at the average income percentile, labor income percentile for people who are in the top decile of capital income. So before more or less 1990, these people were below the median of labor income. And this changed from the mid 80s. So today the average percentile is about 65. Okay, so this is quite a drastic change. So this is the main result. And an important question is what drove this measure of inequality up. So we hypothesize three possible mechanisms, which we might say something about. The first mechanism is, first, there are some high paying jobs. So people who are not necessarily capital income rich are labor income rich. However, because they earn enough in terms of wages, they can save large fractions of their income, then invest it, and at some point start earning large capital incomes. The second mechanism is somewhat different. We first have large capital incomes for some capitalists who don't necessarily work. They invest in their children's human capital. These children receive high earnings, and at some point these children receive large inheritances and start earning also large capital incomes. The third mechanism is that let's say at some point high earnings are not available, for example, when income inequality of labor income inequality is low, then people who are capital income rich are less interested in the labor market. And then only when labor income inequality increases and high paying jobs become more relevant for them, and those capitalists which are now drawn to the labor market are also earning large labor incomes. So all of these three mechanisms can live side by side, okay? They are not mutually exclusive. But we are trying to understand which of them is more probable. We don't have really good data to do it. It's very hard to disentangle between these mechanisms. And what we do is something very naive and simple just to inform this discussion. So we look at four key variables, which are a priori independent, independent meaning that mechanistically they're not dependent on one another. Marginal labor income inequality quantified as the top 10% labor income share, marginal capital income inequality measured by the top 10% capital income share. Then the capital share of income. Okay, so how much of the total income or the total national income is capital income, so in which we know has increased over the last few decades. And then a measure of interest, the top 10K, top 10L. And what we do is a really simple linear regression, a linear model in which we will ask how the top 10K, top 10L is dependent on each of these variables between 1986 and 2020. These are the results, super simple. What we basically see here, and I'm not going to dwell on this too much, that the only robust finding is that there is something to be explained between the dependence of the top 10K, top 10L, and labor income inequality. Okay? So the other variables, again, the capital income share and the top capital income inequality then the couple income inequality are not robustly, are not, the findings that are that they are not robust in explaining what is happening to the top 10K, top 10L. And we can see it even very simply by this graph. What this graph shows us is that instead of measuring the top 10K, top 10L, we could have simply measured labor income inequality and basically use this naive linear model to predict what would be the top 10K, top 10L. And the correlation is very high, something like 0.96 or something. It also works when different data sources are used. I'm not going to show it. The important thing is that in terms of the mechanisms, it's more likely that mechanism one and three are relevant because we need high labor income inequality, or we need increasing labor income inequality to happen for homoplasia to increase. This is basically what we are trying to argue here. Again, this is not causal. We don't have such a good data to say anything about causality here, but this is still an indication that this is what's going on. We can talk more about it soon. So the last thing I'm going to discuss is how homoplasia is related to income inequality. So we basically just saw that in order for homoplasia to increase, we need increasing, or we believe that we need increasing labor income inequality. Question is, what about the other direction? Did increasing homoplasia did anything to contribute to the rise of income inequality? And when I say here income inequality, I mean total income inequality, the sum of, or basically the distribution of the sum of labor and capital income. Okay? There is a clear mechanical link between homoplasia and total income inequality for a very simple reason. Think about the labor income distribution and the capital income distribution. When we have the same people earning the highest labor incomes and the highest capital incomes, then their sum would be even more unequal than the case in which there is no association basically between who earns what. And I'll show it in a second, but this is just to make this mechanical link intuitive. We are going to test this link by modeling the copula, so the joint distribution of labor and capital income ranks, as a Gumbel copula. This is not something we invented here. This is something that the people have used in the past, and we also discuss in the paper why we believe this is a good model for the copula. The key advantage of using this copula is that it is characterized by a single parameter. So we can play with this parameter to test how much homoplasia is affecting, or how homoplasia is affecting total income inequality. And we do this by synthetically match the labor income distribution, which is given to us, and the capital income distribution, which is again given to us. And what we do is we use a synthetic copula, if we'd like, to match together who earns what kind of income and how much of it. Together, this matching allows us to calculate or to look at the sum of labor incomes and capital incomes to obtain the total income distribution. So just to give you an idea what, how does the copula look like, this is an example for 2018 for this copula. This is a representation of the copula. It's a 10 by 10 matrix. Each element of the matrix tells us what is the conditional probability to be, say, in the seventh labor income decile and the 10th highest capital income decile, 7%. So each row and each column here sum to one, to a probability of one. And these copulas tend to have this very typical shape. A lot of weight across the diagonal, and they are asymmetric, usually in the sense that there is more weight towards the top. So this value here, this element 10, 10, is our measure of homoplutia. This is the top 10K, top 10L. Again, this is the probability, the conditional probability to be in the top capital income decile, conditional being in the top labor income decile. This is very similar to how Gumbel copulas look like, and this is the reason we basically use Gumbel copulas. So then we do, the first exercise we do is we take, for example, the labor income distribution for 1985 and the capital income distribution for 1985, and we match them together with the Gumbel copula with a parameter that we tweak between homoplutia of 10% to 100%. And the same, it is the same we can do for every year, and you can see it here for 1985 and 2018, and you see basically what I argued before that. Just mechanically, if homoplutia is higher than the total income inequality, in this case measured by the top 10 total income share, it is increasing as homoplutia increases, and it actually increases more rapidly, or the derivative is highest in the relevant within the relevant range of values for homoplutia, which is between 10 and 30. This is historically speaking what we saw. This is where this sensitivity is relatively high. And then we can do what I think is slightly more interesting exercise. We can actually ask, did rising homoplutia lead to more inequality? And we do the same thing more or less. We use the Gumbel copula. There's two counterfactual scenarios. One is when there is no change in homoplutia. So we take the copula for 1986, but we let everything else change according to its real historical change. So the labor income distribution and the capital income distributions change according to their historical evolution, but the copula remains the same. And the other kind of factual scenario is that there is no change in the capital share. So we fix the capital share to be in its 1986 level, but we let everything else change as it really did. So the same, homoplutia increased, labor income inequality increased, capital income inequality changed a little bit, but the capital share stayed the same. And in each case, we ask, how would the total income inequality, what would be the total income inequality evolution in each of these cases? And how does this look like? So here in black, you see the baseline. This is what really happened. So what really happened is that the top 10% total income share went from 37% to 47%. So it increased by roughly 10 percentage points over this period from 1986 to 2020. If there was no increase in capital share, this is in this dotted gray line, you can see that the increase in total income inequality would have been slightly milder, but only slightly, roughly in half a percentage point over the entire period. However, if there was no increase on homoplutia, difference become quite large towards the end. So it opens up until 2000 and then again, at some point until 2020, roughly 10 years ago, and all in all, it's of about 2 percentage points, which is 20% of the entire increase in inequality, which, again, this is not causal, this is only mechanistic, but this is quite large. So in this sense, we say that Ceteris paribus, the increase of homoplutia explains about 20% of the total increase in income inequality in the US. I'll just briefly to say something about the UK, something that is not in the paper, I just did quickly because we are in the UK, and to show that there wasn't that much of a big increase in homoplutia in the UK, there has been something, some effect, which is rather small between 1980 to 1995, but it seems to be rather flat sense, at least using the LIST data. In Israel, which is another country which I looked at using the LIST data, I would say that it is slightly more, but not as big as in the US. Okay, let me just wrap up. Enclos is a relatively new phenomenon with relevance to multiple aspects of the economy and economics more generally. It was low in the US after World War II, and since 1985, it has been sharply increasing and currently at record levels. Rising enclos is likely to be driven by increasing labor income inequality. We show that ceteris paribus, rising enclos account for about 10% of the increase in total income inequality since 1986. I want to stress that past periods with high interpersonal inequality, for example, in the 1920s, we had high inequality, we had high capital income ratio and high capital share of income. More or less like today, but it is very likely that homoplutia was low 100 years ago than today. And this is an important thing to remember when we draw similarities between today and this period of about 100 years ago. And there is much room for future research in terms of how it affects intergenerational mobility, about policy, and also about the profiling of who is this homoplutic elite. That's it. Thank you very much for listening. I'm very happy to take your questions.
Thank you so much. I have a question from Stephen.
Hi, thanks for the talk, Jonathan. Two questions. One is homoplutia, does it have a fractal structure? So you've talked, you've assumed 10% is the relative threshold here. But what happens if you use 5%? That's the first question. The second question is a bit more fundamental, is in trying to think about homoplutia and whether or not are we interested in the joint distribution of labor income and capital income? Or are we more fundamentally interested in the joint distribution of income and wealth, which is not quite the same thing as what you're looking at? And I don't know if there's a right answer, but I think thinking about it might help sharpen why we might be interested in homoplutia as you and Branko describe it.
So thanks for the questions. But regarding the first question, I actually have a slide. So it might be the easiest to go to this slide, which you can see here in there. So these are what we call them homoplutia profiles. So this is what happens if you measure the top PK, top PL, P being the percentile going from 100 to 1. So you can see there seems to be no structural break. So if we were looking at the top 5K, top 5L, it's more or less the same. Also for the top one, there are some slight differences, but they are quite small. So I hope this answers the first question. Regarding the second one, yes, it's definitely an important point which we don't discuss in the paper. I think first, it's more related to, so the angle we came to think about this question is related to first policy. So in terms of taxation, I think it's very relevant to think about sources of income, because this is first what usually is taxed rather than wealth. And the second is the more traditional, let's call it political economy type of thinking, that you know, the capitalists are not necessarily those who are wealthy, but those who are earning rents in a way. So despite the fact that you're right, it should go hand in hand. So the wealthy are supposedly also those who are earning rents, but it's actually not the case. So we were thinking more about people who are earning income from rents and how they're related to people earning labor incomes. but it's definitely something to consider. And actually, it's not something we can't do, but we can do it also quite easily, I suppose. And I would imagine we would see more or less similar things happening. I would be surprised if we would look completely different.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions? There are questions in the chat. I'm going to read them out otherwise. So this one is related by Alexander Pepper. Many high-paying jobs help executives receive substantial payments in the form of shares, which would seem to be an important variant of mechanism one. Then there was a question. I'm just going to read them out and then you can answer them afterwards. Another one by Aaron and Barney, who has unfortunately left us, but I'm going to read out his question anyways. Sorry, just a second. I'm not clear on why taxation is harder if people at the top are getting more labor income than one might think that ties them to the local economy more than if they were merely earning capital income but could live anywhere. So maybe you want to comment on both of these comments.
So the first point is a point that we've been asked about many times, especially because, I mean, this big change that we see that happens around 1986, it's more or less, or basically it's when there was a major tax reform in the US, which we know that has led to a change in the structure of compensation of top executives. So my answer to that is first that if our results would have been substantially different for the top 10% or top 20%, then perhaps this could have been related to that. But when we are talking about the top 10% or top 20% even, which this is very far from being, you know, executives. These people who earn, people in the top decile of labor income in the US are, you know, even nurses, engineers, all across the board, doctors, very far from this view of the top 1% or even top 0.1% of labor income earners, which for them may be this structure of compensation and, you know, bonuses and just stock options could have made a huge difference. And we have also some robustness tests to see if this really drives the results, and it definitely doesn't. This is one thing. The other question about the policy and the taxation, I think it's more about a conceptual point or an ethical point, which I think some people would argue that it is harder to, I mean, think about what is it that we want to tax. So we might want to tax things that we I would say it differently. It makes sense, at least to me, more. It makes more sense to tax rents than it is to tax wages. And in the standard view, where different people earn differently, or when different people earn wages or get high rents, it's easier to plan tax policy which takes this into consideration. However, we know that, again, people at the top, especially people who earn high capital incomes, are increasingly more likely to earn high wages. And again, it seems to be less ethical. I would say the word ethical here, although I can understand why this sounds like a normative or a value judgment that I make, but it seems to be just harder to justify if it's the same people who earn both types of income. But again, I think it's it's somewhat of a valid judgment, and also I think politically harder to pass these kind of policies.
Okay, I have Chico next.
Hi, Jonathan. So first, let me apologize for having missed most of your talk because I was in a meeting that overran that I couldn't leave, and therefore I should really be quiet. But since I saw that there was a room for questions, I just wanted to ask you the following question, and apologies if you've already discussed it or if it's a silly question in light of what you've presented. But thinking about the topic of this paper, I thought, well, the fact that there is homoclutia is perhaps unsurprising, an unsurprising consequence of the fact that most labor earnings are now a return to a form of capital, which is human capital, right? And presumably you may have started with this. So when we was farmers and lords, the lords owned the land, they owned the capital, the farmers had the work. So the people who earned labor incomes were not the people who earned incomes from rents or capital. But now most earnings from labor, particularly at the top end, are returns on very high levels of human capital. So you could think of homoclutia as a natural consequence of portfolio diversification. Rich people send their children to Princeton and Harvard or Oxford or whatever, and they get huge salaries. Afterwards, they also inherit this thing. So there's just a diversification. You know, the portfolio of the rich people is diversified and includes human capital. So then what's the problem? The problem is that we think of the allocation of human capital as being not only something that you can buy, but there is an element of skill and merit. And, you know, you go back to Raquel Fernandez and Rogerson and so on, tournaments versus markets, there's sort of skill versus what you buy. So I guess my question about this human capital side of things is, Is homoclutia a good thing that comes because people with high levels of human capital are now buying into popular capitalism and also earn physical capital incomes? Or is it a bad thing that arises out of the fact that the rich are able to corner the market in extremely high yielding higher education for their children, despite the merits of other people? I don't know if this is something you've been able to go into at all, but I just wanted to ask that broad question.
Well, I think, thanks for the question. I think it's a very good one, and it's something we have been thinking about for sure. And also, it is slightly related to the mechanisms that we had in mind when we try to understand better what are the drivers of homoclutia. And yes, definitely, when you think about homoplutia, you tend to think that it's generally a good thing because it means that we are no longer in this world of capitalists and workers, which is perhaps a very frustrating economic system. And it doesn't sound like it's the best form of capitalism out there. But I think what you said exactly about the exact point about human capital that you made is actually the reason why we are trying to raise this flag that rising homoplutia might reduce intergenerational mobility for the next generations. Because if it is the same kind of households who own both human capital and say financial or physical capital, it's no longer the same as it was, again, 100 years ago, where you could invest, for example, in things like public education system or public health systems, which would help kind of even out the field for everyone. Now it seems like when there are more and more people who have both, again, say human capital and financial capital, they will always be ahead in terms of gaining more of both types of capital, and therefore it might limit the ability of those who are at the bottom to catch up. We don't have an empirical analysis of this, but this is some form of a mechanism that we have in mind for why homoplutia or rising homoplutia in one hand seems to be a good thing, but on the other hand might also lead to things we might consider as bad. So a full answer to your question, because we are only at the beginning of understanding better this phenomenon. So this is perhaps the idea behind this paper, is to, you know, describe the phenomenon empirically, show how it is related to inequality, but leave a lot of place for future research.
Okay, there are now three hands up, so I would ask Azif, Victoria and Alberto to each post their question and then have a joint answer maybe by Jonathan.
Hi, thanks a lot for your presentation. That was really interesting. I have sort of two questions you can briefly touch upon. So as a sociologist, I'm mainly interested in the individuals behind the data you presented. So can you say a little bit more about what we know about their main sources of capital and income? So for example, when we speak about higher wages, do we know anything about the specific occupations that people have? And what are maybe other main sources of capital and income streams? And the other question, you briefly touched upon this in the beginning, what are the sort of implications for social mobility? Because you said that one driver of homoplutia you presented was that people with larger incomes can better invest in their children's human capital and so on. So I wonder if you are considering or following this sort of intergenerational perspective as well, or so planning to do so.
Victoria?
Yeah, thank you so much. I have a question, kind of whether you have looked into or have any like anything to say about like how top incomes have developed in absolute terms, and like what role that plays in income inequality, because like some of the salaries that we see nowadays, for example, in the financial sector, like didn't exist like a few decades ago, and kind of this explosion of like top incomes, which could, I guess, also be an argument for a more progressive income tax system, you know, from this kind of ethical point of view. You know, are salaries at that level even justified for any kind of job?
Thank you. So no, I was thinking in a more sort of political economy framework, I don't know, Zucman, Syed, and this type of work, how in this period there is a lot of changes in taxation as well, right? In particular, they argue, no, that capital income taxation go up and labor income taxation is going down. So it would be nice to have an idea of how much this impacts your results, right? How much of these results can somehow be related to this evolution of taxation. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for these questions. I'll try to answer briefly because there's a lot to say about it. I see if the points that you made exactly the room for future research that I have in mind. I think there are many aspects to study further. One of them is kind of the profiling of this homoplutic elite. Who are they? In terms of what you said, occupation is one thing, age is another. There are so many dimensions in which we can understand them better. We did nothing of this sort in the paper. And not, for example, in the US DINA, we can't do much about it, only some, but in the CPS, for sure, there is much more that we can do because it's a survey with a lot of information in there, but it's not the idea of the paper and we didn't do it. And another one, which I actually think is So I think there are three important aspects to for future research. One is this profiling, or who are the Homo Plutos. Second is to understand better the drivers of Homo Plutia. So I think our analysis is a bit naive, and it's only there to try and say something about the mechanisms that we have in mind. But I believe that with better data, more can be done. I don't think it's easy, but I think to make something more causal perhaps is important, because our analysis is again a bit simplistic, and it's really not the focus of our paper. And the third aspect is the one about the effect on intergeneration mobility, which I think is really key. Victoria, regarding your question, I don't think I can answer. I think we really didn't touch upon, I even didn't think about looking at the top 0.1%, for example, and see how they behave and you know, try to look at the composition of income there. Actually, if this is something you're interested in, I think the Smith and co-authors QJE paper from 2018, Capitalists in the 21st Century, is the place to look at. This is a very detailed paper exactly on this. And on the last question on taxes. So yeah, it's a question that we didn't do anything about. All our incomes are pre-tax. So there is no direct impact of tax policies. Again, not direct. Of course, indirect, you can say it's there, but we didn't try to answer how it affected what we're looking at. But yeah, it's another important thing to think about. Thank you for these questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions? If not, we're perfectly in time. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for a very interesting presentation. Thank you, everyone, for joining the discussions today and for a very engaged round of Q&A. Just to remember that on next Thursday, May 6th, we have the public event, Are Regional Inequalities Driving Us Apart? Geographical and Political Polarization in the Age of Populism, chaired by Neil Lee. And I'm looking forward to seeing you all there as well. Have a great day. Bye, everyone.